Independent filmmakers Les Blank and Maureen Gosling. This program is one of three in the series The Independent Eye, American Independent Filmmakers. Other filmmakers in the series include Wayne Wang and Julia Reichert and James Klein. This program was written, produced, and engineered by Benjamin Shapiro. Additional engineering, Larry Cronin. Production consultant, Marilyn Pittman. If you would like to order cassette copies of this program or others in the series, write to The Independent Eye, 311 Bryn Mawr Southeast, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87106. Comments about the program are also welcome at this address. This program was produced with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through National Public Radio's Satellite Program Development Fund. The program was produced by Benjamin Shapiro, who is solely responsible for its content.
That concludes the three-part series, The Independent Eye. If you have any comments about the series that you'd like to pass along to us, our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. It's 4 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 o'clock this evening for All Things Considered. This evening on All Things Considered, President Reagan's policy statements on Central America. We'll hear reactions from Mexico and Brazil, countries that could be in danger, according to the president, from the spread of Nicaraguan terrorism. Also today, winners and losers in the farming industry, and co-host Noah Adams talks again to an Iowa farm couple he interviewed a year ago to find out how they're doing today. That's beginning at 5 on All Things Considered. That will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. With me now on Fresh Air is conductor Dennis Russell Davies. He's dedicated to performing new music, but his repertoire spans several centuries. He's given first performances of works by Cage, Carter, Berio, Glass, and Rejewski, and has created some very innovative programs like pairing works by Wagner and Philip Glass. From 1972 to 1980, Davies conducted the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, which he led to national prominence. In 1975, he co-founded and became principal conductor of the American Composers Orchestra, which performs contemporary music. Davies is also the principal conductor of the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, which is the summer home of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He now lives in West Germany, where he's about to become the general music director of the city of Bonn. Since 1980, he served as music director of the Stuttgart Opera. Dennis Russell Davies is in Philadelphia to guest conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in performances this week and next. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You're known for your conducting of new music, but I wonder if people maybe didn't warn you when you're getting started that that was a great way to alienate people and to not get invited to places.
I saw today a copy of an article in the Sunday New York Times by Eric Leinsdorf, in which he refers to the conductor as the composer's advocate. And I think it's a wonderful phrase, and I think that there are more and more of my colleagues have come back, I think, to the original purpose of their calling, which is not only to preserve our classical heritage and to preserve the great music masterpieces of the past, but also to act as the composer's advocate and to see to it that the music of today is played enough so that the great pieces from today will have their chance to become classics in the next century.
That really does put you in a completely different relationship with the music, because you can go out and find composers whose work you want to play, and you can speak to them about that work. How do you take advantage of that ability to talk to the composer?
I think it's probably the most joyous aspect of my work, in a way. It's the good friends I have who are composers who are able to come to me, we're able to talk, we can make programs scheduling their music, being able to conduct the first performance of a piece that is seeing the light of day for the first time. It's a wonderful experience, and as I say, it was at one time regularly a part of every conductor's life. And I've been very pleased that over the last 20 or so years that I've been in this business, that it's been one of the really exciting and positive aspects, especially when you have the chance to work with composers who have their roots firmly embedded in classical music. And that, of course, makes a wonderful possibilities for juxtapositions and exchanges of ideas.
Was it difficult to establish yourself being as interested in new music as you were? Did that make it hard in any way?
I guess I was warned when I started out to stay away from new music because it was sure to be damaging to a career, but I found it to be just the opposite. As a matter of fact, some of my early mentors were both conductors and composers, and as conductors they were very dedicated to playing classical music and to preserving classical music. Bruno Maderna was a conductor that I was very close to, especially just in the years before he died. He was had a very popular success. I remember I came and saw the Philadelphia Orchestra for the first time, actually, with Bruno Maderna conducting. And it was a memorable experience for me. And I had a chance to be around Bruno. I played some of his music, and he conducted the Juilliard Ensemble in the days when I was assistant conductor and pianist with the ensemble. And so I had a chance to work under him, and Pierre Boulez as well.
Can you remember what it was that excited you initially about new music? And it's interesting to me that some people are interested first in new music and then go backwards and discover classical music history, and others approach it the other way around.
That's, I think, what you just mentioned is probably the normal, especially for young people. And many of our younger members of the audience first become attracted to classical music at all through new music, many of them through the music of some of the minimal composers from the day, Philip Glass. Others of the younger audience through the classical 20th century literature of Stravinsky, for instance, or Bartok, or Charles Ives in many cases. And then they hear something that they recognize also in the classical repertoire. Myself, as a classically trained musician, was exactly the opposite. I mean, I cut my teeth on Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, and Chopin, and especially when I was dead set on being a concert pianist. I remember at age 18 sitting in a class at the Juilliard School, and Norman Lloyd, who was a very well-known teacher of theory and composition and also just literatures of music, brought some recordings and scores in of music by Charles Ives. And he played a recording of Howard Hanson conducting the Second Symphony. And I still remember it was a very emotional experience for me because suddenly I was listening to classical music that wasn't foreign anymore. It was classical music that was really of my own country, my own place, and really of my own people. And that meant a great deal to me. And that particular symphony, the Second of Ives, is one that I've performed a great deal in Europe because it's given me a chance to play for Europeans a music that shows a different side of the America than they usually hear or see.
What do they usually hear and see?
Well, when we talk about in terms of contemporary music, of course, they're mostly confronted with the more advanced aspects of our 20th century music. And Ives is our romantic composer and represents the 19th century.
Since you've just mentioned Ives, why don't we listen to you conducting a movement from his third symphony?
Gustav Mahler saw the score of this symphony and liked it very much and was intending to take it with him back to Europe. And this was in 1910, and Mahler died in 1911, which was unfortunate for Ives because this piece then had its actual world premiere not until 1947. It was 1947 in Town Hall with Lou Harrison conducting, a performance which Ives then later got the Pulitzer Prize at an age that was much too late to make any difference to him.
Can you discuss, before we hear this, what some of the pleasures and challenges were of conducting this piece?
This particular work is, of course, very strongly based on the American hymn tradition. But it's a very complex work, and it's written very harmonically, very tonally, but all 12 tones are used with very interesting juxtapositions. And it takes a while just to get a very clean and thorough reading and for the musicians to relax, having mastered the technical aspects of the piece. Then they have to sit back and play it as if it were a Mahler symphony, in terms of its classical tradition.
We're going to hear the second movement from the Symphony No. 3 by Charles Ives. That was Children's Day from Charles Ives Symphony No. 3. And we heard the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra conducted by my guest, Dennis Russell Davies, who is in Philadelphia to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's really a wonderful performance of the piece. And there's so many times when the composition just, you know, picks up on American folk themes or familiar themes. And just as you're really getting involved and it veers off into something totally unpredictable. And I'd imagine if you were playing it, that just as you were giving yourself over to something that was very familiar, you'd have to withdraw from it. Is that tough to conduct something like that?
Well, it's the similar. I think one of the things that attracted Mahler to this music was that they both had the gift of in their own melodic writing, of being so convincing in the style that many times their own melodies that they invented sounded like folk melodies, and you're not really sure what is a quote from something, what is really actually an original Ives or an original Mahler theme, that just because of their dedication and thorough schooling in the folk idiom, it's really hard to tell the difference.
What about that unpredictability, though, that going along with something that seems, that sounds familiar, even if it wasn't written by somebody else, and then it starts getting dissonant, and the chords start getting weird, and everything starts changing on you, and you can't, you know, you can't just like go with it, you know, as if it really were that familiar.
Well, of course, we have the advantage of playing a piece that we know very well,
so it gets familiar.
It does get very familiar, yeah.
Ives is someone who you wouldn't have had the opportunity to talk with about a piece, but when you're, say, conducting something by Philip Glass,
mm-hmm.
Will you talk with him about how he envisions it being performed? Especially, you did a first performance of one of his pieces, so you couldn't, even if you wanted to, have listened to somebody else's concert or recorded performance of it. What kind of advantage do you take of your ability to talk with him about it?
Well, it's always fun and interesting to have the composers present. Generally, a composer before the world premiere of a piece is pretty much in the same position as an expectant father, and perhaps just about as useful. although I think today expectant fathers are becoming more useful, and I think we can, as conductors, can also bring them into the process in terms of their new pieces being played. It's one thing to be able to talk and ask them questions and to hear their reactions. But basically, once a composer has finished the piece, then it's ours to interpret. And many times it'll take two or three performances and maybe even two or three different performances before a composer can begin to even critique his own work and perhaps then begin to make changes.
Is it exciting for you the first time you approach a piece that you've never heard before and you're just seeing it on the page?
You see it on the page and you hear it.
You hear it in your mind.
I hear it, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Of course, it's an exciting moment. We commissioned in Stuttgart the Glass opera Akhenaten to be played. It was in our 83-84 season. That was a world premiere that we gave there. And that was a season that we were going to be playing in the small acting house because our big opera house was being renovated. So Philip had certain restrictions on the size of the orchestra he could use because we were in a smaller pit. We were talking about that in particular size, and I remember he told me he wanted very much in this opera, as opposed to the others, to be able to use brass instruments and percussion instruments. And then I suggested to him that he could use a large orchestra, but if he eliminated violins from the orchestra and use a string orchestra of violas, cellos, and basses, and then winds, normal winds, and brass and percussion, we'd have room for an arrangement like that. And I suggested he listened to the Brahms A Major Serenade and suggested also a couple of works by Berio that where violins weren't used to see how he would, you know, come to grips with a sound like that, and which is in fact what he eventually ended up doing.
Do you feel that there's a special rapport that you can have with a composer like Glass, since you're contemporaries, you're close to being the same age, and you probably have some kind of shared cultural and musical experience because of that?
Well, I've enjoyed, as I said, I've enjoyed the relations I've had with all the composers whose works I've done. I'm very, very close to composers who are considerably older. Lou Harrison, John Cage. Lou Harrison is in his late 60s, about to be 70, and Cage is over 70, unbelievably. And I mean, these are, of course, have been for me wonderful learning experiences as well.
Because Philip Glass's music is precise and repetitive and so multi-leveled, it must be very hard to keep track of it. It's not as evenly on a beat. I mean, I just can never figure out how musicians even keep their place when they're performing it. So you're kind of there to help everybody do that during a performance. What are some of the things you have to keep in mind for a performance of Philip Glass's?
I don't think really anything that wouldn't apply to almost any music by any composer in any time. I think that one of the aspects of Philip's music which makes it the most difficult is that it's extremely simple on a technical level. It's extremely simple to play. And many times it's irritatingly simple to play. But it requires a perfection in the playing that then makes its own difficulty. I can perhaps the one classical composer who is somewhat akin to that, it'd be one comparison, would be Mozart, where there's a wonderful saying that Mozart's music is too easy for the amateur and much too difficult for the professional. And I think Glass's music in that sense is almost the same. We had last season at Saratoga Springs, the Philadelphia Orchestra played for the first time several works by Philip Glass. It was a juxtaposition next to Wagner. And I remember with such fondness and really astonishment, the total professionalism and dedication that the orchestra brought really to both of these featured composers, but also hearing, we played the second act of Philip's Akhenaten, and it was very, very little rehearsal time. And the orchestra's approach was impeccable in terms of working at the working atmosphere, but also just in playing, sitting down and playing the music. They didn't have problems, and they just did it.
Which is very interesting, because the Philadelphia Orchestra really does not specialize in new music.
Neither do I. And I think that's one of the important aspects of music making today, is to find musicians who are able to play old music and new music, sit down and do one and do the other without really thinking about the term specialization. Music is music.
When you play Wagner in America and play it in Germany, does it take on different meanings in each country?
No.
Is the music seen differently at all?
No, I don't think so.
What were the connections you saw between Wagner and Philip Glass that made you think it would work? They'd work well together on a double bill, so to speak?
It did work very well, because both composers have made, I think, their essential impact in the world of theater music. And both composers have had a very strong influence on how we regard time in music and the passage of time. And in a certain sense, length of time. I know people who have been unable to sit through without really being uncomfortable some of the longer Wagner operas. And I know others that after they give it a second or third chance, then suddenly find that they are able to deal with these enormous lengths. We're not really used to sitting down and listening for long periods of time the way people would do in the late 19th century.
You said before that you think it's really important that conductors and performers be able to play a wide span of music, new music and music of the past. There are many audiences that are resistant to adding the new music onto the bill, and that's one of the criticisms that's frequently made of the Philadelphia Orchestra audience. And I wonder how you've gone about, in places like St. Paul, for instance, trying to balance older and contemporary music.
For one thing, I guess I would have to say your first statement regarding the Philadelphia audience. I think each season there's been at least one major new piece on the program that I've been asked to do. And I know that Ricardo Muti is greatly broadened the programming of the orchestra here, and I know that the audience seems to be coming along. So I think maybe some of the suppositions or some of the things that you're suggesting perhaps were true a number of years ago, but I think it should be also publicly said on the air that things have changed, and I think that's a very good sign. I've lived now in Europe since 1980, and I find now, as I read about music in the States and when I come back to conduct, I'm finding that the audiences here have made a great leap. And I think one of the reasons is that the performing musicians have just taken it in their hands and said, this is something that we want to do and something we believe in and something that, that should be part of concert life.
I'd like to play another performance that you conduct. And this is a piece by composer Arvo Pärt.
Pärt.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know much about this composer. If you
Arvo
Pärt
is, this is a recording that came out on the ECM New Series label. It's a recording of music by Arvo Pärt. Arvo was an Estonian composer who emigrated from Estonia about 8 years ago. Actually had permission to emigrate and was on his way to Israel and stayed in Vienna in transit and then ended up living in West Berlin. And Arvo writes a very intensely religious and music, very passionate music. He's an example, if you want, of European minimalism, Eastern European minimalism. This particular work that you're going to play was recorded with my orchestra in Stuttgart, the Staatsorchester Stuttgart, and it's a piece that Arvo wrote called In Memoriam Benjamin Britten. It's a very, very beautiful piece, very interesting work.
Why don't we listen to it? And this is conducted by my guest, Dennis Russell Davies. That was the Cantus in Memoriam of Benjamin Britten, which was composed by Arvo Pärt and conducted by my guest Dennis Russell Davies. Really a beautiful piece. Mm. And there's an incredible tonal sustain at the end. It seems that after the musicians have stopped playing, there's a ringing.
It's a chime that sounds intermittently all through the piece. And then it sounded just at the moment the strings cut off. And you don't really hear the attack. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, it almost feels like the accumulation of all the music that you've heard continue to ring. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you get very moody when you conduct a piece like that?
Or? No. That's our job, to communicate an emotion like that to the audience, but it's something in the music, not something inside us.
You were trained as a pianist. Did you think you were going to become a soloist or a performer before you became a conductor?
I had the idea that I would be some kind of concert pianist. Yeah.
What changed your mind?
A lot of people played a lot better than I did. And that actually is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, there's a certain amount of truth to that. But I also found at a certain point that I had gifts as a conductor that were not really being utilized as a pianist. In my early 20s, I began working in areas of conducting and hearing and being able to tune things, and also working with people. That's something that I'm good at and I like to do. And as a solo pianist, that's an aspect of your work that's not really necessarily called upon.
When you decided to shift towards conducting instead of a solo career, mm-hmm. did you start to de-emphasize your own playing? Did you play less?
Yeah, I did for a while. I almost didn't play at all, which was a big mistake. But I had a lot to catch up on. Then when I started this group called the Juilliard Ensemble with Berio, I became the pianist in the group and had to very quickly get back in shape. And of course, at that age, I mean, I was 24. You don't really lose too much. And then since then, I've made it a practice and a habit to schedule myself to play and to be playing regularly all the time. So I'm in pretty reasonable shape and I play a good deal.
During that period when you'd given it up, did you feel if you weren't going to be the most brilliant pianist and if you weren't going to be a piano performer, then what was the point of playing?
No, it was nothing like that. I was just very busy investigating this new possibility and learning scores.
A lot of people who aren't composers envision that if you were composing, you'd have this great sense of power because the whole, you raise your arm and the orchestra sounds, and you know all those people who like sit and conduct records in their easy chair. Did you actually get that rush of power when you started conducting?
No.
Or do you think that that's a stereotype that people who just
it
aren't involved
very,
in this have?
A very dangerous idea for someone who wanted to be a conductor to even have this aspect of the feeling. I think I don't think any of my colleagues would have to admit to a feeling like that, because it really has nothing to do with the work that we do. You know, it's a very demanding discipline, it's a very hard discipline, and it's basically involved with helping good people play together and being in a position to use our ears and our intellect and our intelligence through a musical form that requires this kind of interpretation. And with a symphony orchestra, of course, and with a very good symphony orchestra, as members of the lay audience can see very well, there are many times when a conductor is not superfluous, would be wrong, but a good orchestra could really handle a particular repertoire and music very well without us. But there are other things that require really, especially the music of the late 19th century and then, of course, the 20th century are presence is very, very much required, just because of, for one thing, the size of the ensembles involved and the very size and complexity of the numbers of instruments. And if you think of singing yourself and then trying to be together with someone who may be 20, 25, 30 feet away from you, you basically hear your own voice and trying to hear them. And that's the position that an orchestral musician is also in. It's one of the attractive things also of conducting in the opera, because the opera is the really one great last medium where a conductor as a position, as a figure, and as a musical activity is absolutely needed.
In coordinating the singers and the orchestra.
Absolutely. There's no possible way it could happen without us.
For the concert-going audience, the time you see the conductor isn't during the rehearsals, isn't during the period when the music's being interpreted. It's during the show, during the performance. And perhaps because of that, it seems that showmanship has really just really become very important.
I think it is important. The work in rehearsal is very interesting. It's very intense. It's a very private affair between the conductor and the orchestra. Many times it's very stimulating. It certainly is for me. But then comes the moment of truth. And what you've done the work for is then to go on the stage and present this music to the audience. Then you want to have a little something extra. The orchestra wants you to have something a little bit extra. They're not interested just in somebody who can come and do a dandy rehearsal, because that they could do themselves. They also want to have the combination, and then to have someone standing in front of them who can inspire them and be inspired, above all, be inspired himself.
So do you think that you really emphasize that showmanship aspect when you're on the podium conducting in a performance?
You don't emphasize it, but if you have it, then that's when it comes out.
And
there's a big difference in what you just said and what I just said.
Right. You're right. Because what I would say, you could interpret it as like faking it or acting or something.
Then you turn it on. No, it's like being an actor and anything else. When you have the working period and then you have the performing period. And when the adrenaline starts and the standing backstage a half a minute before you go on, that's when you start cooking.
It's interesting that in America, I think European conductors are really coveted, and there's a kind of special aura that European conductors seem to have. And I think it's most unusual for an American conductor such as yourself to have such a prominent position in European musical life.
It is unusual. There are some colleagues. I have some American colleagues in Europe, but it is more unusual, I think, than the European conductors here. That's true.
How was that match first made? How did you know, end up in Stuttgart?
I guest conducted there in the late 1970s. Actually, I was introduced to Stuttgart through the composer Hans Werner Henze. Stuttgart became his sort of resident opera house. They put on over a number of years all of his operas. He staged many of them, and he asked me to conduct them. So my first two productions in Stuttgart were Henze operas. Then I was asked to conduct The Magic Flute of Mozart, and then the work had gone so well, and they suddenly found themselves with an opening for a music director, and they asked me if I would be interested, and of course I was, and I took it. It's been a very, very fruitful relationship, very interesting. It's a very big responsibility. They're very big jobs. The opera in Stuttgart has a repertoire each season of 26, 27 different operas. We do 5 or 6 new productions a year. The orchestra, I have this state opera orchestra, and they do also 8 pairs of concerts. And, there's a budget in the Stuttgart Opera of $45 million a year, which is a lot of public money. And it's a size of activity that I think a lot of people in the States don't really realize what it is that actually is going on over there.
Well, in the States, opera has a pretty specialized audience, which has been broadened considerably, I think, especially since the recent public television broadcasts, which have introduced a lot of people to opera. But
I think that's, I must say, I think that it's nice for public television, but there's been a huge opera audience in the United States for over 100 years. I mean, the Met's been touring for decades, and Texaco's been sponsoring the Met broadcasts, which have been listened to by people all over the country for years. There's a big, big opera public here, and the people have traveled long distances to go to it. Now, it's true that there's been a chance to see more of it on TV, but that's I think the size of the audience has been here for a long time.
Is the audience different in West Germany than it is here? Is it
much different because there's a bigger tradition, whereas we have a handful of major opera houses in West Germany. But West Germany alone, not counting East Germany, I mean, there must be 60 major opera houses. I mean, just the size, the numbers are mind-boggling. I mean, Stuttgart is a city of 500,000 people, 500,000. And it has this huge opera house, and it's probably only the 7th or 8th largest in the country.
You're going to probably really disagree with this, but it seems to me that in many parts of America, opera has an almost class distinction, that there's, you know, that it's mostly the middle and upper middle class people who can afford to go and who end up developing a taste for the music. And
I don't disagree with that at all.
Oh, okay. But I would guess it might be a little bit different in Germany, that it might be a more like populist music there.
I'm not sure it is so different. But when you say middle class, of course, in this country, you hit a lot of people. And
I think that
you know, the work is there in terms of opening all of the serious arts to a larger audience is true not only in the United States, but is true in Europe. I mean that we're very proud when we have our large audiences for concerts and activities, but I mean, let's face it, when we put that percentage in terms of the total population everywhere, it's a very small figure. So that I think that work is to be done both here and abroad.
You're about to become the music director for the city of Bonn. What's your job description going to be as the music director for a city?
Well, it's going to be an interesting job. My first responsibility is for the orchestra of the Beethoven Halle. That's the orchestra that plays in the city, the Beethoven Halle Orchestra. Starting in my second season, I'll also be a music director of the opera. And then I'm in charge of the chamber music series that are done there and the new music days. And there's also a couple of choruses there that I have to look after. Doesn't mean that I personally do everything. But you see, and also these jobs are very political.
Meaning?
You know, in Stuttgart, for instance, I'm music director of the state opera. And I mean, I'm appointed by the legislature. And in Bonn, I was appointed by the city council. And my immediate boss is the city manager of the city. And, you know, I mean, these are major public monies are invested in these institutions, and the people that run them, it's a regular political appointment. As a matter of fact, I was voted, beginning of February, voted on by the city council, and there was a coalition of political parties that put me through.
Do you like that kind of arrangement?
Why not?
Well, on the one hand, it's such an honor to be voted in by, you know, by your city. On the other hand, there might be a level of bureaucracy you have to answer to and a degree of politicking that might be contradictory to the kind of independence you might want. I don't know if it gets in the way or not.
No, it doesn't usually get in the way. But let's face it. I mean, if you're investing public monies in anything of that size, then at least there's someone always looking at the bottom line. That's no different than in this country.
Well, in this country, arts organizations have such a hard time surviving. They have to be looking at the bottom line.
Yeah, well, of course. They do everywhere.
Yeah. You are still, even though you're in West Germany, you're still conducting at Saratoga in the summer, and you're doing the Composers Orchestra in New York, and this week you're in the Philadelphia Orchestra. And like many composers, you are like really jetting around the country frequently, taking, you know, guest conducting or taking on other regular assignments. And how do you think it's changed the art of conducting to have the ability to roam around the world like that? It's really only in the past few decades that's been an option for conductors.
Yeah, it's a beneficial thing to a certain extent, and it's also can be difficult and can be dangerous. You have to, I think, really keep level-headed. And one of the things today, you have to think so far in advance. I mean, we're barely into 1986, and one makes plans for 1989, 1990, 1991. It's difficult to pin yourself down so far in advance, and everything that's 3 or 4 years away sounds like it might be feasible. I think there's probably a growing tendency on the part of my colleagues, and I know I feel it too, to reduce this kind of jetting around activity to a certain extent, to make sure that we're able to take care of our home bases and take care of our home jobs. And, you know, it's there's a certain point in your career when there are a few important things that you want to say yes to, and it happens to everybody that you say yes to several things and they all come through.
Right.
And then you've got to pay the piper.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, there's a wonderful aspect of the international music profession today, and that is really the chance to appreciate and to enjoy standards and high standards all over the world, and to visit a place and then to go home and to be able to bring some good aspects of the regeneration that you experience by going and being a guest in a different city. At the same time, though, it is important to establish a home base, and it's something I feel very strongly, and it's something I try to do, is to keep the center of my work in my home in Germany right now.
So you do feel that sometimes the jetting around for some conductors interferes with their home orchestra?
Yeah, it has with me from time to time, and I've had to learn to say no.
How's your German?
Very good.
Did you know it well when you moved there?
When I moved there, yes. Yeah. When I started to work there as a guest, I could speak a little, and I engaged myself very intensively so that I was able to. I've always spoke German in rehearsals, and it's one of the nice aspects of being in Europe, is a chance to work in different languages, and so I like to do that.
Are there any different customs in Germany for the orchestras than in America that you've had to adjust to?
No, there's a different style of playing.
That's a How's the style
different
of
tradition. It's just that's almost a little too technical to get into.
Uh-huh.
It's just something you notice. I mean, how the musicians react to a beat, just appreciation and devotion to different kinds of music. There's some music that an orchestra in one place, and it's even within countries, you just notice it. One composer in an orchestra sits down and plays, and you don't have to talk about anything. They just do it naturally. And the next composer from a different period, it's like they've never seen the thing before. You know, that you find this all over the place. It's one of the interesting aspects of it, really. One of the things I enjoy. And I find that conducting in different countries, in France and Germany and England and the States primarily, has broadened my technique and my abilities as a conductor, because you learn to, as a conductor, you play the instrument that's in front of you. And it's a very enjoyable aspect of it.
What's the transition been like for you and your family to become residents of Germany?
It was a interesting, difficult transition, but it's, again, I think it's an interesting part of this profession, being part of an international community.
Do things surprise you when you come back to America about how either the music scene's changed or new shows on television? I don't know.
Yeah,
things have changed a lot.
I'm continually surprised and very pleased, actually, by things that have happened. And I see a lot of progress. I think I said before, and we were talking about especially broadening of the repertory and even the recognition that there are a lot of great American symphony orchestras. I mean, we have, you know, a handful, six or seven, that are considered to be really top drawer. But, I mean, there are really probably a dozen others that play extraordinarily well. And it's fun to see I find a deregionalization in the United States, which is very healthy and very, I think, a good sign to the future.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for spending some of your time with us today on Fresh Air. Thank
nice
you for being
here. Nice to get
some
fresh air.
My guest has been conductor Dennis Russell Davies, who is visiting Philadelphia to guest conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra this week and next. He's currently living in West Germany. He's right now the conductor of the Stuttgart Opera, but he's about to become the music director of the city of Bonn, West Germany. And for about 8 years, he was the conductor of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Well, it's about 3.5 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air, but first, why don't we check in with Shadow Traffic?
Well, jam traffic continues in Center City, a gridlock situation developing just like it did yesterday afternoon, because there are no buses running. The trains are running, but they're running 30 minutes late. Expect delays because of heavy ridership. Schuylkill Expressway westbound, a 20-minute delay between the Twin Bridges and City Avenue. Eastbound, only sluggish through the reconstruction area. No major problems north on 95 this afternoon. Southbound, you'll find traffic jammed from Route 413 down to Street Road because of late construction. That's shadow traffic. I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM WHYY.
That shadow traffic report was funded by Superfresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Susie Orbach, who has written extensively about eating disorders. Her first book was Fat is a Feminist Issue. Her new book is called Hunger Strike, and it's a study, it's a social analysis of why so many women have become anorectic. At 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by songwriter Ellie Greenwich, who wrote many of the great girl group hits of the 60s, including Leader of the Pack and Be My Baby. Thursday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Dr. Carol Gilligan. She's a professor of education at Harvard University and author of In a Different Voice, a study in the contrasting ways men and women develop morality. This Sunday at 6, on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who's one of America's most prominent and controversial ministers, and he'll reflect on his role as a peace activist and spiritual leader. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Scott Williams and Audrey Voblaitis were the engineers. Production assistance today from Mildred Moffett. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
Any little storm or wind, you know, we'd just be sick because we know it was just taking more of the bank out. And we've put everything into this house, and if we lose it, well, we don't have anything else.
Ruth Kenney's house is on the shore of Lake Michigan and in danger of falling in. The water is high in all the Great Lakes. The story's not in All Things Considered.
Also, acid rain, the issue between President Reagan and Canada's Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney.
Reaction from Brazil and Mexico to President Reagan's speech about the communist threat in Latin America.
A new study of high-tech farming indicates
the small family farm may not survive.
Some good gold padding in California.
And some thoughts on chocolate. But first, this news update.
This is Mark Boardman. The Soviet Union today launched an official protest after two U.S. warships last week cruised through waters claimed by the Soviets. The incident occurred when the two ships passed within 6 miles of the Soviet coast in the Black Sea. The Soviets say the area is theirs. The U.S. says those are international waters. A Soviet official called the alleged incursion provocative and warned of severe repercussions in the event of any future incidents. The Pentagon has called it an innocent passage. French President François Mitterrand has taken the first steps towards securing a new government for his country following this weekend's election. Today he called in Jacques Chirac, leader of the RPR Conservative Party, and asked him to form a new government. Chirac is the mayor of Paris and served as French premier from 1974 to 1976. He promised to get back to Mitterrand as soon as possible with a response to today's discussions. The State Department today handed over to the Philippine government copies of documents seized when deposed President Ferdinand Marcos fled to Hawaii, hundreds of pages, which the Philippines government hopes will uncover the extent of Marcos's wealth. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, a House Foreign Affairs subcommittee has voted unanimously to subpoena the documents. Stephen Salars, chairman of the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, explains why that panel took the action.
Determine whether, in fact, any American foreign aid funds for the Philippines were recycled by the Marcoses or any of their cronies into real estate investments in the United States. So far, we have not uncovered any direct evidence which would establish that such manipulations took place.
As the panel continues its investigation, it also voted to subpoena 8 more people. President Reagan's bid to provide $1 million of aid to rebels in Nicaragua continues to generate controversy within the U.S. and abroad. Brazil today demanded clarification of a statement Reagan made in his Sunday night speech. Reagan had said that Nicaragua's Sandinista government was supplying arms to Brazilian radicals. In the U.S., nearly 100 demonstrators opposed to the aid request have been arrested. Congress is scheduled to vote on that proposal on Thursday. President Reagan and Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney have reportedly agreed on action to combat acid rain. Details will be announced tomorrow. Some U.S. officials say the president will endorse a program committing the U.S. to spend $5 billion to test methods of curbing acid rain. OPEC oil ministers today wrapped up the third day of emergency meetings in Geneva, but still did not reach a decision on how to combat falling world oil prices. Burton Bolag has details.
OPEC President Venezuelan Oil Minister Arturo Grisanti told reporters this evening he was confident the conference was moving gradually toward some decisions. The fact that the oil ministers had decided to continue their meeting
Again, we're not willing to put all of this